And we're live here on Facebook, Augusta Free Press. I am Chris Graham, joined by Scott German, and we're here to talk some sports news. And we'll talk later in the show about Major League Baseball and its apparently pending return. But first, we're going to talk some UVA football. Scott, a story that that you picked up from a Utah publication, former home of UVA football coach Bronco Mendenhall, of course, all the years he spent out at BYU. And a story that kind of offers some insight into our coach Mendenhall from folks who've known him for a long time out that way. And you thought some interesting insights there. So go ahead and share some of that, Scott, and we'll discuss.
Yeah, I told you that I read it. I found it very in-depth. It must have been that Coach Mendenhall may have had a prior history with this reporter, journalist, because it wasn't generic black and white answers. He went into great detail about a number of topics. One, why he left BYU. Coach is not really wanting to play the next game against BYU, which we have scheduled, I believe, next year. But the BYU folks aren't really playing ball with UVA and sort of digging their feet in. They want that game. And Coach Mendenhall really does not want it, and he goes into detail about why he doesn't want it. So, yeah, I found it to be an interesting article. It's in the Desert News, which I'm assuming is either a Salt Lake City publication or a Provo publication, somewhere in that area. But they cover BYU football because there's tons of BYU stories along with this as well.
So, what were some of the reasons given? I mean, you know, not wanting to play that game. And I know why BYU wants to play it. It's a chance to get back in sense with Coach Mendenhall. But why does he not want to play it? Aside from the fact that he was a coach there for a long time, his family has all those ties there. Did he give some reasons as to why he doesn't want to play that game?
Yeah, he does. But let's start with we'll get to that. But if we can follow it a little bit I think this is important because, you know, this kind of falls under the category, if you're given lemons, why not make lemonade? And we've all been scratching our heads a little bit, maybe, as to what has happened all of a sudden to UVA football recruiting. We've really picked up, you know, really started to bring in some really, you know, three or four star players. And there's a five-star that just made Virginia his five in his last 10, you know, his 10. Virginia made the final 10 cut, in-state player. They're getting some in-state players. So the story basically starts with what Coach Mendenhall is doing now in this environment, this COVID environment. And very interesting because he says that his coaching staff is really, really emphasized working on the things they can work on. And one of those things is, even though it's pretty much a dead area in recruiting, they're laying a lot of groundwork for recruiting. I've got the story up. I'll just kind of read you a couple of quotes. They've been, for the most part, focusing all their efforts since players left grounds on recruiting. And, you know, maybe that's kind of a byproduct of why we're doing so well. So he goes on to say that we didn't get spring practice this year, which we all know. And that's afforded us extra time for recruiting. We would have finished spring practice this week. So we've had 5 weeks of extra time, 5 weeks of time that we have spent putting our efforts into recruiting and redefining the recruiting process here at Virginia. He goes on to elaborate very much about the academic standards and how he's turned that from what some people would think is a negative, the high academic standards in Virginia. He's equated it to usually find players that have really good academic background are high quality players, which is one of the things that Coach Mendenhall, you know, he looks for. He looks for those high integrity type players. He talks about working remotely out of their homes and also very interesting. So he's asking the players. The players follow a very detailed, laid out schedule from their home. He has them get up at the normal time they would get up, because at UVA, they practice in the morning and they have a very regimented schedule in the morning. So basically these players are doing the, following the exact same scheduling from their home that they would if they were on grounds, as far as getting wake up calls if they need it, to their eating breakfast, to their being in meetings. So it's a, he has gone, they have spent enormous amounts of time laying out this detailed structure for his players as to what they're doing, and also the time that they've spent. He calls it redefining our recruiting process. And basically he goes on to elaborate, because of the academic requirements in Virginia, not everyone on the, out there on the recruiting trail that they run into are Virginia type candidates. But according to Coach Mendenhall, they really are, because he's found that those high academic players are generally high quality players as far as their character, and that's what he's trying to bring into to the Virginia football program.
Yeah, you know, it's, all that you're talking about there is so interesting. Yeah, we've been able to talk. It's been a little bit of time now, but the UVA media relations folks, the sports media relations folks, have kept us in good contact with the football program, coaches and players. And yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a regimented schedule. In terms of, you know, of course, the hard part is, and I'm trying to find some stuff here on Twitter. I follow the UVA football Twitter account, and we're seeing the players having issues in terms of, you know, not everybody has weight rooms in their house, obviously. I mean, you have these great facilities on the college campuses across the country, and the players don't have that at home. But it's to a point where that trainers have developed these programs to say, okay, what do you have? What can you work out with? What can you do? And then they work around that schedule. And yeah, they're making sure that they developed a coach's tree, and the position coaches are responsible for getting in touch with their players on a daily basis. Are you still doing your schoolwork? Are you doing your, you know, are you doing your training? Are you, you know, all the things that you'd be doing on a daily basis if you were in Charlottesville training through the spring and now into the summer, right? They're doing that virtually. And so it's fascinating what they've had to build to be able to, you know, to keep guys on the right track, because I mean, we know that, you know, when things pick back up, and if you look at the state of Virginia's schedule that has been laid out by the governor, Ralph Northam, you know, we're about to enter what he's called phase one of a 3-phase process for getting things back towards normal. And that's going to start on Friday for most of the state. When that ends up being the case, he's talking about phase two starting in 2 or 3 weeks, and phase three is essentially things being somewhat open as they were, you know, back a couple months ago. That's looking like the middle to late part of June if you look at the schedule. That means, you know, theoretically, I would suppose that means the guys are gonna be back on grounds at UVA and back on campuses across the state, and I'm sure a lot of states across the union are doing the same kind of things. And so that's not far, though, from the start of training camp in July, late July. And so, these guys got to stay. They have to, you know, do what they can to stay in shape. And I was reading, I think it was Dylan Rinkensmeyer. I was reading about him today and what he's doing. He lives out in Colorado. And there's a nice story on the UVA website about how he's using the high altitude in Rocky Mountains as part of his training. You know, he's an offensive lineman. But he's doing what he can in terms of hiking and using the what he has his abilities to stay in shape. And you know, there are some guys who have weights that, you know, maybe have a garage with weights in it or whatever. I remember I think it was Charles Snowden was talking about how he doesn't have any weights. He does push-ups and he can do some running out and, you know, out in his in front of his house, but that's about it. So. But yeah, they've developed this system. And you know what, Scott, I mean, we know Scott, we know Bronco Mendenhall well enough to know that this is the case. But for our viewers out there, there are players and coaches who are talking about how, you know, Bronco kind of quietly, almost perversely kind of likes what's going on right now, in the sense that he loves seeing how his players, how his team responds to challenges. There's no greater challenge than trying to maintain a semblance of a football team through this situation. And so he's really, all of his coaches are talking about this particularly. He's really using this as a barometer to see just how his guys respond. And he fully expects to be able to come back and with training camp later, you know, in the summer, with guys who are ready to play some football and have worked their way through this. So that's a revealing story, though, that the perspective of the folks out there in Utah having, and they've known him for a long time, that they know him as well as we do now, in the sense of just what Bronco does to keep himself and keep his organization moving in the right direction.
Yeah, and you know, there's I kind of thought it's kind of obvious how much respected he was there, that they're still following his almost every move, and he's been gone almost 5 years.
Another, we'll get
back to his story again, because it does, it's just an excellent article. Please read it when you have a chance. Desert News. The other thing that this could do is, this could possibly, this shutdown that we've had, really level the playing field a little bit. Because, you know, you got to wonder, a lot of these schools with all these five-star players, I wonder how many of them might be just kind of taking it easy a little, maybe not as structured as what Virginia is. And all of a sudden you thrust these kids back into summer camps where you're only a month or so away from the season. And, you know, it sounds like from what I've been reading and from what we've been shared with us by the UVA sports media, that our players really aren't missing a whole, I mean, they are missing the fact that they're not able to be there in practice, but they're not on vacation by any stretch of the imagination. So this might level the playing field a little bit between the Alabamas and the Georgias and the Virginias of the world. And we'll find out real quick if we do have a season, because we open up with Georgia.
I would assume Nick Saban is going to be just as organized as anybody through this process. Yeah. You will see other coaches, though. You're going to see who earns the money they're paid, I guess, is a way to put this, because, this is a challenge, to say the least, to keep, you know, for basketball, for example. Basketball has the buffer, you know, college basketball doesn't start, practice doesn't start until October, season doesn't start until November. They'll have a little bit more of a buffer. But football, yeah, football with camp starting in late July, at least scheduled to start in late July, I mean, yeah, you got to keep your guys in shape now. Plus, football is a sport. I mean, you know, for basketball, obviously, every sport you're going to need to stay in some kind of shape, and not just stay in shape, but, you know, be building towards the future. But basketball, as long as you have a hoop out in your yard, you can, you know, in your driveway, you can work on your game, keeping your game shape, and you can do sprints and that kind of thing. Football, I mean, you know, linemen need to be strong, and so they need. You know, and nobody has a home weight room set up with the amount of weight that offensive and defensive linemen need. I mean, you know, you're talking about guys who squat 600 pounds and bench press 400 pounds. Nobody's got that sitting around the house. So, it's going
to
be.
And sometimes they need people to block and people to tackle.
Well, there's even that. I mean, eventually you do need that. You know, just the weights. I mean, I used to be a big power lifter before I lost weight and became a runner. And, the only places where you can squat 600 pounds or bench press 400 pounds, that's gyms. I mean, nobody has that sitting around their house. And plus, you need a spotter. You know, if you're going to do that kind of weight, you need a spotter too. And so, it's a challenge, but we're going to see. We're going to see who has done the work of the Mendenhalls, and who kind of just rolls the ball out there and you know, lets guys play. Those kind of coaches aren't going to succeed in this year. You're not having the access to your campus facilities. It is going to, don't know about even thinking out with the big boys. I would assume, again, that the Sabans of the world and anybody in Saban's coaching tree, and that includes Kirby Smart in Georgia, I would assume those guys are like the Belichicks of the world. They're not going to be bothered by this. They look at this just like Mendenhall does as a challenge. But you are going to see this, Scott. I think you're exactly right. You're going to see other coaches. We're going to unmask other coaches who maybe – make more than they should be making. And we're going to find those guys
who makes a habit out of just rolling the ball out, you know?
Yeah, definitely. That's going to be quite interesting to find that out. So, we've learned a lot about this. I mean, just the UVA sports media relations folks have done a great job, I think, of keeping us in touch with the UVA programs, the basketball and football programs in particular. And I've been impressed with what I've heard from both. We were just, I think it was about maybe a week and a half ago, Jason Williford joined a Zoom conference that we were on, and learning what Tony's done similarly to keep his guys in contact. And that's what everybody's doing now, in that sense. It's a lot of keeping up with just making sure we have we touch base, and everybody touches base. Because now the school year, I guess, is coming to the end. But this is going to be a challenge too for especially football players, actually basketball players too, to a degree. Athletes in environments like UVA, ACC level athletes, Power Five conference athletes, usually load up in the summertime on their credit hours because, I mean, football, obviously football with all the practice schedule, the travel and everything else. For that fall semester, it's really tough. And basketball is really a two-semester sport. I mean, you start practice early October, season goes through mid-March into early April in some cases. That really covers both the semesters of that year. And so you load up on your credit hours during the summer so that you can take the minimum that you can take during what's the school year for everybody else so that you can, balance out the requirements there. And not having a first summer session is going to be a challenge. It's going to throw some guys off. And so, how schools manage through that process, that's not something you think about when you watch the games in football stadiums in the fall and basketball arenas in the winter. You don't think about the fact they are student athletes. But that's something that the coaches are definitely, keeping in touch with their players on, keep your head down, keep in shape, and keep your academic course, moving forward so that, all those pieces can play together and allow you to have success in this environment. It's gonna be tough, but from what I'm hearing with Bronco Mendenhall and his group and Tony Bennett and his group, those guys are going to do just fine.
Yeah, I don't have any doubt that preparation is not something that Virginia fans have to worry about. Virginia lacking when we do get this season started, football or basketball. So the article, the other many interesting points in the article, but addressed his decision to leave BYU. Uh-huh. And he made it very clear that it was a very difficult decision. But one of the reasons is that the challenge of putting together a schedule, not being in a conference, having your team ready to play. He really said that outside of four or five games a year, it was difficult getting quality opponents on the BYU schedule. And that at Virginia being a part of the Power Five, that wasn't the case, that you were facing a quality opponent every week. He also made it very clear. I think he's alluded to this in other stories and interviews, that it was certainly a joint decision. He and his wife have a strong spiritual faith driven marriage. And they made this decision as a family with his three sons, that if any one of the group said that it was not a good move or didn't feel comfortable with it, they wouldn't have done it. But he also went on to say that when he arrived at Virginia, literally, he said it was far worse than what he thought. The exact quote was, and I have it in front of me, it wasn't secure. It wasn't successful. The program was struggling in every area. But we were really clear that what we believed and wanted to make a difference somewhere else, especially in the mission field. And he goes on to say that even though it's not a Mormon, you know, made up team, there's still challenges there for mission type work. And he said that the realization of what he was inheriting came at the first team meeting. And he said there wasn't a player in the room, and I'm going to find this quote so I don't misquote it, that upon the first team meeting, or upon the first arriving in Charlottesville, that there wasn't a player in the room that could make eye contact with him. And that basically the room was filled with despair. Boy, that says a lot, doesn't it? About what mess he inherited from the previous coaching
Well, staff. I say this all the time about a guy, you know, when a new coach comes in, the new coach comes in because the other guy got fired. And so, yeah, I mean, you don't fire a coach unless they haven't won. So, you know, and I'll say this on the side of players who couldn't look him in the eye. I mean, part of that is I got recruited by the previous guy and his staff, and I maybe don't fit into this new guy's way of playing football in this case. And so, you know, I only get to be a college student for 4 years, maybe five if I have a redshirt year. If I've got to transfer out, then, you know, I got to. So there's a lot of reasons to be scared that have nothing to do with whether or not you're a high caliber kid. I mean, and whether you're Mike London or Bronco Mendenhall, you're recruiting kids to come to UVA. They got to get into school there. They're high quality kids. I would downplay a little bit of that just to say, I can identify with the kids who are scared that, man, you know, man, I got to maybe I had to transfer out of here. I got to go somewhere else. I got, you know, or maybe not. And, you know, and now the guys that Bronco recruits, they know what they're getting into. They know they're getting into where they have to earn their number. You know, I don't know. People watching the show know that we're, you know, if you're a UVA football fan, you know all about the earn, not given. And you've got to meet certain benchmarks to even earn the ability to pick a number, much less play, you know, that kind of stuff. But, you know, if that could be scary. And if, you know, if you're told that when you're a high school sophomore thinking about UVA, it's one thing. If you're sitting there in a room and you've already used 2 years of your eligibility, you've got two more years to go, you know, that kind of stuff can be scary. So, but yeah, he inherited that and then he wintered it down and he, you know, we remember that he only kept what was eight players from that first recruiting class. One of those guys happened to be Bryce Hall. And Bryce Hall was a two-star recruit and he turned him into an NFL draft pick. So he and his staff did, and Bryce worked hard to get there. So I don't know. I mean, I look at that and say, you know, I feel for the kids in that kind of situation. They're stuck. And the ones who wrote it out eventually played in a bowl game, you know, the ones who were underclassmen and played through that 2-10 debacle, that loss to Richmond, everything else. The second year they got to play in a bowl game. And the ones who were recruited got to play in the Orange Bowl. That's how quickly he turned things around though, Scott. He went from the kids couldn't look him in the eye. They couldn't beat Richmond. They got blown out by Richmond in the first game. They went from that to the Orange Bowl in 4 years. That's an amazing turnaround in what he was able to do there.
Yeah, so let me add something to that, because I don't want to be accused of being one of these networks that just give you little bits and pieces of sound bites. And then, so he did say that they really couldn't even make eye contact with you. But he said they were in despair and there was no interest. He sensed that there was no interest in playing the game or being affiliated with the institution or representing it through football. It's been an amazing and rewarding experience of building young people through the game of football here at Virginia. You know, he did. We all know that he went into the rotunda and addressed the board of visitors. I guess it was the state of the football program. And he essentially said, what, I have 25 ACC caliber players.
I think he said 27. 27 was 81. One third of his players were ACC caliber players. Yeah.
Yeah. So that doesn't really give you a lot of confidence if you're sitting there wondering if you're one of the 27 or one of the 54 that is not up to snuff. But the article also goes into living in Charlottesville, which he loves and his family loves, and he loves the sense of community. He goes on to say that he loved living in BYU, but in BYU, he could not escape Brigham Young football wherever he went. There was no privacy. He didn't mind it. He loved talking about it, but he literally said when he went into restaurants, it was just a matter of time before he had to stop. And, you know, I can understand that when you're with your family, you don't want, but in Charlottesville, he said it's been exactly opposite. He can live in relative obscurity. So, I've heard that as a reason given for why there are a lot of celebrities living in Charlottesville, because they can come and go and become part of the community without feeling as though, they don't have any, they're living in a fishbowl. And he also goes on to elaborate after the riots and how the community merged together. So, it just made me feel like we've got a coach here that's in this for the long run.
Charlottesville has that interesting dynamic to it, and it has for a long, long time, where, he mentioned celebrities who live in the area and have lived for a long time and live and do so in obscurity. People from Dwayne Johnson to Sissy Spacek, obviously John Grisham, people like that. I don't know what it is about people who live in and around Charlottesville, and we're two of those people who live in and around Charlottesville. We just don't pester folks. We just, hey, look, there. You know, if you acknowledge it at all, you say, hey, there's John Grisham. Nobody, he's not mobbed at his table when he's eating on the downtown mall. He's John Grisham. He's the guy. And then there's somebody else over here. There's Katie Couric over here. And, there's Chris Long, who's eating a sandwich at Little John's. And we just don't bother people the way they get bothered other places. I don't know what it is about Charlottesville that's that way, but we're just that way. We've had that reputation for a long time. It's very accurate and dates back as long as I've known anything. It's always been that way. So, yeah, you can be Bronco Mendenhall. You can be Tony Bennett. You can just do your job, do it well, and you can also go to Costco and be a regular person. Now you can't, like you said, Scott. When you're the coach, when you're the football coach at BYU, you're pretty much the Pope in Utah, and it's hard to be that guy. You're the football coach at UVA. You can go out in Charlottesville and be a regular person. Outside of those football games, and that's a great dynamic, I'm sure, for those folks.
Yeah, I thought that was really an honest. He wasn't saying anything negative about living in Utah, living around BYU, but he was saying that he felt as though he had no privacy when we're in Charlottesville. He's just kind of one of the folks that live in Charlottesville.
The only time it gets changed is when Scott German sees him at Costco. That's the only time he gets bothered by anybody else.
Yeah. And he probably can give a party and not have to worry about random strangers walking through his house,
Scott German's not going to show up. Well, I shouldn't say that. You probably will show up at his house. But, you can just be a person, and that's a great thing. And that's not saying anything bad about Utah. That's because it's an honor, I'm sure, to be the Pope in Utah if you're the football coach at BYU. But it's also tough. It's also tough living in that fishbowl. So,
yeah, I actually attended. I went to the UVA BYU game there back in the 90s, and it's in the desert, but it's absolutely breathtakingly beautiful with the mountains in the background. I'm talking about mountains that you could stack two Blue Ridge Mountains on top of. In the middle of September, when the football game was played, from about halfway up the mountain to the top was covered in snow. And it was 80 degrees at kickoff. That's an unusual feeling to be sweltering hot on the football down on the field and look up and see snow in the mountains. So I'm sure it was beautiful. It is beautiful, but he wanted a challenge. He said that there was a challenge there. They felt as though there was a higher calling to leave BYU. And a lot of it, he did say a lot of it was because of BYU's unwillingness to join a conference.
Well, there is that. And he talked about that, I remember, at his first press conference in Charlottesville back in December of 2015. There's a path to getting into a playoff situation eventually through a conference. And this year he won a division. And so, you know, it's going to be the case in the next few years when we're going to see the playoff expanded from its current four, probably to eight, it, potentially to 16, who knows. But when it goes from four to eight, you can almost guarantee that Power Fives are a conference is going to have an automatic bid in that eight. And, you know, so you can be UVA, win your Coastal Division. You can upset Clemson. If you can do that, you're in a playoff. And if you're an independent, you have to go 12-0 and hope. You have to go 12-0 and hope if you're an independent. And so, yeah, he saw that years ago. And he talked about that in 2015, and it's still the case now. It's going to be the case again in a few years. We're going to see the money is there to be made to play a bigger playoff. And he's going to – he's already got his program in a position to compete for championships, and it's only going to get more so as the next few years roll out.
Well, and the recruiting is really picking up. I mean, it's great to be able to build great teams from 2- and 3-star players, but it doesn't hurt to have some 4-star guys come into that fold too as well, and that's what we're seeing now too.
Well, he's following in what Tony Bennett was able to do with basketball. And this is the case. It's what George Welch did. It's what Frank Beamer did down at Virginia Tech. You've got to win with the 2- and 3-star guys. You've got to wring more wins out of those guys than they should give you. And when you do that, then that turns into, hey, now we get 4-star players now. And then you wring more wins out of those guys, and eventually you get some 5-stars. We're starting to certainly seeing that with the basketball program. But when Tony Bennett was able to turn some good players who were recruited to win 20 games, the Malcolm Brogdons and Anthony Gills and Mike Tobies, and he turned those teams into 30-win teams, then you get access to guys like Kyle Guy and Ty Jerome and DeAndre Hunter. And then now look at this year's group coming in. But you've got to earn the opportunity to get those kind of players. And Bronco, we're still in phase. This is like phase two for Bronco. He turned the Bryce Halls and, you know, a 2-star guy from Pennsylvania, Bryce Perkins, junior college quarterback who got, you know, let go from his first program and turned him into an NFL player. And, you know, you've got to convince those guys that they're better than the star ratings tell you. So that you can get the kids with the star ratings, and then you win with those guys, and you see what Tony Bennett's done. You'll see Bronco Mendenhall's on that same track. He's a step or two behind just because he started later. But man, oh man, you're seeing it. I mean, he turned a group that had no right winning the ACC Coastal last year. As much as we're homers, there's no way that team should have done that. They did it, and now you're seeing the results in recruiting. The recruiting is going to continue to pay those dividends for UVA football fans for a long time to come.
And you know, the mentality or that we saw, that we've seen him develop within the team, even in the last game of the season, if you recall, the Virginia Tech game, I mean, that game turned and Tech had the upper hand in that game late. And we just, sitting beside me had to be very difficult because it was – I could just, you know, same old, same old. But something happened. And I think it's just that mentality that Coach Mendenhall is building at UVA, that those players had the ability to dig down deeper and they knew that they could win that football game. And boy, what a turnaround that last four in the fourth quarter of that game.
Yeah, because that's the game, you know, for the folks who, of course, all we remember now is we won the game, right? But had a touchdown lead at halftime, which is not rare in the 15 years. Virginia was competitive in a lot of those 15 years in that 15-year streak. But in the second half, yeah, Tech turned it around. I think they went from down 13-6 to up 27-20 just like that. They scored on 3 straight possessions, and they were moving the ball at will and stopping Virginia. And then – so, yeah, that's what happened in every one of those other games for the 15 years. At some point, Tech took control, and on their sidelines, their kids had to be saying, see, here we go again. You know, we don't have to worry about getting down to these guys. We'll just come back and play, and we'll be the Roadrunner. They're the Coyote, and they'll lose, and we'll win. We'll beep, beep, and we'll move on. And I've been saying this for years, Scott, that UVA was not going to win that game until they could figure out a way to win that game. And it's kind of circular reasoning, but those kids had to prove to themselves they could win the game before they could even believe they could win the game. And they did something. And that coaching staff did it. They somehow convinced those kids. The heartbreak of that year before, I was in that stadium down in Lane Stadium where they had everything but won the game, and then still snatched defeat. To see that group have it happen again to them in Scott Stadium and then come back and win that game was nothing short of remarkable. To convince that group of kids they could do that was interesting. So. Fascinating. So we'll have to put a link to that story on the stream here and get people to kind of connect with that story about Bronco from that BYU perspective. Sounds like a really interesting read. And Scott, we can't hear you because I think you muted yourself when your dog was barking. So,
okay, how's
here
that?
You are. Here you are. Here.
We didn't get into the reason that he really doesn't want to play that series with BYU. And it's, you know, you might think, well, it was too emotionally difficult for him to go back there, or he's got too many friends there or whatever. He actually said it didn't make sense, that they had a number of games already on the schedule when he got to Virginia that didn't make sense. It didn't make sense going to Oregon. It didn't make sense going to Southern California. And he said it doesn't make sense to take the football team all the way to bring them to Utah. That because they were in a Power 5 conference, there were just as compelling games, just as competitive games, a state or two away. And that it was often difficult to travel to games like that for the team. And that he would prefer to stay closer to Charlottesville to play those games. And being a member of the Power 5 conference, was one of the luxuries that he was afforded, is that it was easier to schedule games. So it was, you know, it was literally a logistics issue more than anything else.
I can see that. And you know, there's plenty of teams. If you want to play SEC or Big Ten teams, they're close by relatively, either in your time zone or just one time zone over. That makes a lot of sense actually, from that standpoint. And, so I can see that. And yeah, traveling three time zones, flying 4 or 5 hours one way and all the logistics there, it's tough on both sides. When they have to come back, it's tough on them too. And often you see, we saw this with the scheduling of games when UVA played both UCLA and Oregon. You'll see those West Coast teams, when they schedule the game there, they'll play the game at 7:30 local time at night, and that's 10:30 our body time, and it's tough to get adjusted. Of course, we'll play them and play them at 12 o'clock here. It's 9 o'clock their body time in the morning. And so those kind of that little bit of gamesmanship is played out. Yeah, I agree. It doesn't make a lot of sense to do that. And so I can buy that.
Yeah, and you also have to take into consideration that they have to – it's a business, and it's a lot more expensive to take your team to Utah than it is to take your team to Indiana or somewhere, in the SEC to play a SEC team. So
I can also see BYU, though, being tough, not wanting to get out of that game because, of course, I mean, these are negotiated things. UVA could buy them out, but Bronco knows the hard part of scheduling for BYU. He's that coach has to schedule 12 games a year, and when they get somebody on a signing on the bottom line there, it's hard to get away from that. They need those games.
He said that from right now, as it stands right now, that game, there's two games. There's one back in Charlottesville. They will be playing.
Oh yeah, because BYU has, they're happy when they get a game scheduled. They get a home and home scheduled. That's good. That's one less thing we have to worry about. So. You're not getting out of those games. You can't give them enough money to get out of those games from that standpoint, from BYU standpoint.
So it's a Desert News. It's a long article. Hopefully people will go to it and our viewers will really enjoy it. It's a great article.
So let's talk quickly here. We were talking a bit about, I mentioned at the start, Major League Baseball, I've been updating here throughout the show just to make sure we don't have any breaking news on Major League Baseball. Yesterday, the owners voted to move ahead with a proposal to give to the Players Association that would get the season started, basically an 82-game schedule that would start around July 4th, the weekend of July 4th. And most of the games we played within your division. So we had talked, Scott, a few weeks ago about a proposal that had been floated that would have actually realigned Major League Baseball, at least for this season, into three 10-team pods based on geography. Now it looks like they're going to go back to keeping the traditional alignments, National League, American League. Most games we play within your division, you would play some interleague games based on geography. So the Nats and O's would play some games. You'd have interplay between the East Coast teams, the Central teams would all play each other, and then the West Coast teams the same. And then a 14-team playoff structure, seven per league, with just basically doubling the number of wild cards, and then figuring out how to kind of play through that scenario, probably through a scenario that actually had been proposed in the offseason before we knew anything about COVID-19. That would involve the number one seed getting a bye, a best of three series for the other three sets of teams, division champs and wild cards. But then both leagues would have DH for the 1 year. The National League would have the designated hitter for this season, at least 30-man active roster instead of 26, a 20-player taxi squad. So you would go from a 40-man roster to a 50-man roster, to allow for flexibility with injuries, extended spring training, likely for other minor leaguers on the complexes, both in Florida and Arizona. I think I've covered it all, Scott. Does that sound like what you've been reading about as far as the particulars of the proposal?
Yeah, it does. And it all boils down to probably whether the players are going to agree to take less money.
That is the part I left out. Yes. The part that's the important part. Players have at least indicated, as of late last week, had indicated that they would like to be paid a prorated amount based on their current salaries as assigned for the 2020 season. And what the owners would like to do is essentially split 50-50 the revenues with players, which would then, I guess the way that would then work is you would be paid based on your percentage of the overall salary for the team. So if you're Steven Strasburg, for example, set to make $37 million this year, I don't know what the total salary structure is for the Nats, but let's say it's $200 million. You would be paid 37 divided by 200 million out of that 50-50 split. And there's a lot of math that has to be done there. Players have long made the case that owners have not been forthcoming about all the revenues that go into making up whatever the revenues are for baseball. And so that would be a contention point. But on the other side of it, Scott, if you don't have a season, nobody makes money. So they'll figure the money out, I assume. I think the bigger issue is just seeing how long it takes for them to get to that point. That's my feeling. To me, I think people want to make money. They want to go out there and they want to do what they got to do. What is your feeling? What is your sense?
Well, I agree. And it's going to boil down to the simple math. And the math is, okay, we either sit down in a room and hammer out an agreement between MLB and the Players Association and you make something, or we don't have a season and you make nothing. Now, I was listening to a podcast last night, and actually it was a podcast that Cal Ripken is doing now. Very interesting podcast. He does it a couple times a week, and he had Mookie Betts, who just got traded to the Dodgers for 1 year. And Mookie Betts is facing the distinct possibility of never playing for the Dodgers, because if we don't have a season, he becomes a free agent at the end of the season. And there's also negotiations about what would happen to the Dodgers. Would they retain his rights? Because they gave up a lot of players to the Red Sox for 1 year of Mookie Betts. And if we don't have a season, what happens to his contract with the Dodgers? Does the Dodgers – still have to, does he still become a free agent?
I've understood about this, Scott, is that MLB has already agreed that even if there's no season, the players will get their year of service time. So my assumption would be if you're giving a year of service time to guys, that would go for free agency possibilities as well. That would be my assumption if you're giving a year.
Yeah, I think that's right. So the Dodgers are saying, well, what about the players we gave away? We traded to get Mookie Betts. I guess they feel as though there should be some compensation.
Of course, they would feel that way. But you mean it's a situation where you traded players for a year of a guy that there's no year. You know, the Red Sox aren't going to want to give the players back. You know, I can't see that would be seen as fair on the Red Sox side.
So some of these podcasts, you often hear language that you don't normally hear. On the airways, and I was like shocked. It was like a kid finding out that there was no Santa Claus. Cal Ripken was talking about a story. He was relating a story about a contract year that Eddie Murray had when Eddie was in a free agent year with the Orioles. And he ended up leaving the Orioles and going to the Dodgers. And literally over $1 million a year. That was the difference. And someone asked Eddie about his decision to leave the Orioles, where he was just beloved in Baltimore, to go to the Dodgers. And the question was, how could you do it? What could possibly cause you to leave Baltimore to go for the Dodgers for $1 million? And Eddie's response was, because it's an effing $1 million. So, you know, money talks. Money's the answer to every question. And money's going to decide this. But I think there will be a season that they'll hammer something out. But here's my question to you as a fan. And we're both big stat guys. At the end of the season, should there just be one giant asterisk by it? Because numbers are going to be so skewed, especially if they go through with having DHs in both leagues,
I don't see any need for an asterisk. I mean, I think, you know, I was 9 years old in the 81 strike season, old enough to know. I was already a budding sports writer at nine. I knew what was going on, and they played 108 games that year, roughly. I mean, because they played the split season. You know, they stopped before the strike, started back after, just kind of played the schedule out if they could. Most teams played 108 games. Not everybody played exactly 108. Records, I mean, the records were what they were. Nobody's setting a record. Nobody's going to win 20 games in an 82-game schedule this year. Nobody's going to hit 50 home runs. You know, you will have – what I think is interesting about this is, Scott, so I'm a fan of the Nats. You're a fan of the O's. 82 games – all of a sudden, I mean, it's half the season. So all of a sudden, it seems like to me a lot more teams are in a playoff race with 82 games than there are over 160 games. You know, the lack of depth in your organization shows, you know, when you start losing guys to injury or whatever else. 82 games is a sprint. I mean, I think your O's are, you know, there'll be a lot more teams in contention for those wild card spots.
No, not the O's. The only thing about an 82-game season for the Orioles is they're assured they won't lose 100 games for the third year in a row. That's the only silver lining to this. But that's my point of an asterisk. Because over 162 games, you need a five-man rotation. You've got to have a five-man rotation. You got to have a good bullpen. You got to have a setup guy. You got to have an eighth inning guy. You got to have a closer.
I think it's more pronounced than this because you're going to have less off days. 82 games to get from 82 games between July 4th and the end of September. There's no days off. They're not giving you time off. You're playing games every day. That's one of the reasons for the DH. So I think it's going to make it more incumbent to have a good five-man rotation, to have your seventh, eighth, and ninth inning guys. I think it's going to make it so that you have more pressure to have defined.
So why would you – okay, so – and I'm not disagreeing. Well, I guess I am. It's okay to disagree. So using that mentality, why would you think the Orioles would be possibly able to be in the hunt.
Less games to have long bad stretches. I mean, 82 games is, you know, you're only asking, you only have to kind of spit and tape it together for half a season instead of a full season. I don't know what the Orioles record was at 82 games last year, so I can't tell you. I will say this, the Nats last year would have been, they wouldn't have even been in the mix. They were 19-31 yeah. through 50 games. So,
well, the Orioles had a better record. When the Nats were 19-31, I looked it up. The Orioles were two games ahead of the Nats.
Okay. So, I mean, I look at, and not, specifically the O's, maybe not, but I it makes me think that there's 30 teams. It makes me think that the number of teams that you think are going to be out is automatically is less. It just seems that way to me. You're not asking teams to have to play through the summer doldrums. You know, when teams start wilting, is the young teams or the teams with lack of depth. They start wilting in July and August when, man, we've already played 80 games and now we've got to get through these hot months and you know, maybe we don't have the depth that we thought we had and or we've lost depth, we've had injuries, et cetera. You're starting in July and you're at full strength and it's less taxing on the pitchers. I mean, to me, it seems like it's going to be less taxing. You're only asking your start in an 82-game schedule. If you go five-man rotation, your starter's going to get 15, 16 starts. And so instead of 32, 34, 35 starts. You can maybe ride your guys a little longer if your spring training is done well enough, if your June spring training is done well enough so that they get their arm strength back. You'll see maybe if they're the teams that are not that good but have one or two good starters at the top of it, good enough starters at the top of it, They can mask their inefficiencies better over 82 than they can over 162. It seems to me it's going to keep more teams in play to have a shorter schedule.
Yeah, I can see that. I think that's a possibility. And you know what? The baseball fans, sports fans are going to be so starved for something on TV that they're going to follow it. And by the time they get a little disinterested in it, it's going to be playoff time. And once the playoffs start and the weather turns a little cooler, you know what? The average fan's going to forget all about it. It was an 82 game season. They're going to, I feel like it's going to be play. It's going to be business as usual once the playoffs start, because I really believe for the most part, you'll still see the usual suspects will turn up in the playoffs. I think the Yankees will be there. The Dodgers will be there. The Nats will be there. There might be a couple of oddball teams that figure out a way to make that 82 game schedule work for them. But you're going to see the Dodgers, the Yankees, the Twins, the Nats, the Braves. And by then it's going to be, October. And the, you're going to have fans come back to the game that only tune in October, and business will be, it'll just be like a normal season. So I think the challenge will just get from July to the end of September, if that's when the season is going to end. And initially, everybody will be tuned in. Then you'll have a little drop-off because interest will wane a little bit. But it'll pick back up when the playoffs.
Well, and I think it'll help that around. There's 14 teams in the scenario that's being proposed. 14 teams out of the 30 make the playoffs. That means that not only the usual suspects, there will be some new suspects. There will be some new players that'll – be in the mix. And baseball is a weird sport. I mean, because there's extra spots available in the playoffs, that means there's more teams who will be competing for those extra spots too. That's why I think it's more the fact that when there's seven teams in each league out of the 15 who make the playoffs, that's why you're going to have more competition. When in 82 games, you're just not going to be that far out of the race. Early on, you're going to be in the mix. Mathematically, it's almost impossible to think that anybody's eliminated by September 1st. You're starting on July 4th. So when September rolls around, everybody's got at least a glimmer of hope. It's probably not great hope if you're a Baltimore fan, maybe, but you still have a glimmer of hope. Hey, if we get hot this month, we might make the wild card. And if you're in the wild card, and the scenario they've got right now is that the one seed in each playoff or in each league would be given a bye to the second round. And then the other six teams would play best of three series. Man, baseball is a weird sport. You don't have to be the best team to win a best of three series. You just have to win two games out of three. And so you're going to see some weird upsets. You're going to see this is a year kind of like that strike year in 81. You're going to see some interesting things happen. And you might see a 40-win team, a team with a losing record, make it to the World Series. And whether or not you like that, it's going to at least keep people glued, like you said, Scott. When playoffs start, it's going to keep people glued because you just want to see what happens.
Yeah. And, you know, the Orioles GM made a great point about this. It's imperative for the Orioles to have a season because they have so many young players that even though they weren't expected to be a part of the major league club this year, these young players that would have probably been at Double A, Triple A, their number one draft pick from last season. They had the number one draft pick year before last. They had the number two draft pick last season. They will probably be on that taxi squad and they may actually get to come up a little bit and get some major league baseball experience. So at the MLB level. So it's imperative for these teams that are building, that are attempting to build through their farm system to have a somewhat of a semblance of a season. And I think that's one of the reasons that MLB is really trying to push this together, because baseball is a sport, not like basketball, not like football. These guys that make the major league rosters, they just didn't drop out of college or come out of high school and become part of the major league team. They've spent 2, 3, sometimes 4 years in the minor leagues before they get to that level. So it's important that you give them some semblance of a season.
Yeah. Some structure. Yeah. To continue their development. Yeah. No question. So, hey, we'll have more on this on Augusta Free Press. We're keeping up with the MLB developments and others.
Have you watched any? Did you watch the South Korean League? I actually got up the other night and curiosity turned it on and watched.
I have not yet. No. What's your take?
Well, here's the thing that a lot of people are going to really be challenged to watch a game with no one in the stadium. You pick up a lot of chatter on the field, even though a lot of it is in Korean. you pick up a lot of dugout chatter. The sound of the bat, the ball off the bat is for some baseball nuts like us, it's just electrifying to hear a foul ball come off a bat, to hear a batted ball hit. It's like a gun firing. I mean, it really, I think, magnifies the skill level of some of these players, because you realize how quick a ball is hit and gets to a fielder. They have to field the ball literally, I'd say 99% of it is just on instincts as to where to be. I watched 15, 20 minutes of it. It was very interesting, and I'm looking forward to hopefully the MLB ticket will be in place and we can pick up where we left off and just go around the country and watch all the different games from empty stadiums.
Hey, Tampa Bay Rays fans have an advantage already on the rest of us because they've been watching this.
The Rays may win it all.
They've been playing this kind of baseball for years. That's not going to be anything new for them at all. Yeah, no question. There's Korean baseball. Yeah, we keep up with this on Augusta Free Press. Tomorrow I'll be talking with Rod Mullins. We'll be talking NASCAR. They're actually starting this weekend. NASCAR will be having a race in Darlington this weekend, and so we'll be talking about that with Rod. We'll keep up with the developments in our sports world, which we still have right now. Well, Scott.
So, getting to NASCAR real quick, and Rod. So, not of the fans. I'm assuming that it still has full media access.
No, not full media access. In fact, Rod forwarded me something. Rod and I have both covered NASCAR races. He covers at least a couple races a year, and I've covered some races in the past in Richmond. They're limiting. I'm trying to think what the email. I read the detailed email. It's I think it's two national reporters, one local reporter, and then what they're doing essentially is giving access to all the other reporters who do cover via teleconference, Zoom teleconference, like what we're doing right here. And so the both pre-race and post-race will be handled virtually, so that there's not report. You know, basically, they're trying to limit the number of people who, at least here at the outset, who knows how far this will go into the season, but they're trying to limit the number of people who need to be on site for lots of reasons, logistical reasons. But they're still given great access, it seems. From the memo I read, it gave I wouldn't feel like if I was a reporter, I was getting slighted at all, really, because they're giving you the access that you would need to do your job without making you physically be there. So no, it's really just, like I said, a couple of national level reporters, one local reporter, maybe one pool reporter. So if I think I have that right, it might have just been four or five total people who are there in the media center. When I've covered races in the past in Richmond, for example, Scott, we're familiar with covering things together, UVA sports, ACC level, ACC tournament, NCAA tournament level. A typical NASCAR race has as many people covering probably as the ACC tournament has. And we're talking about going from that level, which is probably, 150, 200 people, to down to about five. A big difference as far as that goes, at least here at the outset.
Well, that shocked me. I was thinking they would have as many, just spread them out, you know, because all the luxury suites could all of a sudden become media boxes. So,
well, I guess it's part of it probably is then if you have all those people, even you spread them out, you still have to have people checking them in and, you know, logistics with that's involved. And so, you know, honestly, Scott, I mean, we've said this a lot. Do reporters really need to be on the scene or do you just need to cover the sport? I mean, at some point, I love going to the games, but, you know, you can do the job from home just as well. So this is maybe something I keep saying every time, Scott, I like these Zoom conferences we're doing and we're broadcasting live on Facebook. There's so many things in the last 2 months that I didn't do 2 months ago. So many people telecommuting. If you can telecommute now and you've been able to work for 2 months, why do you need to go back to an office when this lifts? You know, there's a lot of things I think we're going to be reexamining after things get back to some normal. And I wonder if sports media is not one of them that changes as a result of what we've learned here the last few months, in the here and after.
Yeah, I think, there's going to be a lot of rethinking of everything once we get back to a normal existence, and sports will probably become one of them as well.
Sports media certainly, I think, will.
Sports media, yes.
Sports media definitely will. I'm glad you asked that question because it did lead to, that's behind the scenes. But for people who know the behind the scenes, yeah, NASCAR races have lots of reporters at them, and they'll have four or five. But that said, you know, Rod and I have been strategizing what we need to do to keep those races covered just as well. And I think actually, I don't think the readers will notice anything different when they read our coverage. If a person knows the sport and can relate what they know, you won't know any difference when you're reading. If they don't know it, whether they're there or not, doesn't matter.
Right.
If you don't know what you're talking about, you're not going to know any more what you're talking about just because you're physically there.
And, you know, this is no disrespect to the sport of NASCAR, which, you know, is about to be very disrespectful. But you can sit and watch cars go round and round and round from your home just as easily as you can from the track. You just don't come home and have to burn all your clothes.
Well, what I could say to that is I'm sure that the NASCAR fans could tell you that watching a bunch of guys throw a ball around is not that hard either.
Absolutely. No, I think NASCAR is a great sport.
It is interesting. I'll tell you what, the characters are there. That's the only thing you miss when you're not, for me covering a race, when you're able to walk down pit road and go back into garages, that's where the storytellers, it's just like in pro wrestling. I got this big poster of Shawn Michaels up here. I mean, that's the one thing you miss. You don't, it doesn't translate on Zoom quite as well. The Southern.
We need to get. I've had the pleasure of being able to go have lunch with Rick Mast a couple of times actually in the last year with Rick and Jerry Ratcliffe, who are good friends. We need to have Rick on one of our Facebook Lives because believe me, he can share some stories that would probably make the National Enquirer. So he may not want to share them on Facebook Live. But
he might not want to share them in a recorded session. But yeah, those are some good right. stories. Yeah, in fact, getting Jerry to talk about some of his golf stories and everything else. But there's stories that are told that unfortunately for the vast majority of you watching will never see the light of day, because if they did, the people telling them would get in trouble. But they're good stories.
Yeah, Jerry's got a great golf story about the time he played golf with Sam Snead. So we do need to get Jerry on it. Jerry can tell some great.
I'm remembering some of those golf stories from Jerry. Yeah, we definitely have to get those going. Well, Scott, let's wrap up here. Thank you for your time. We'll get you back on. We'll talk some more sports. Thanks for your time today.
You're welcome.
And everyone out there, thank you for joining us, and we will talk to you again soon.